Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
Today is Wednesday, July the 14th, 2021, at the Midwest Genealogy Center in Independence, Missouri. I'm Marie Steiner, honored to interview Harry A. Pill, U.S. Army veteran, First Lieutenant. I'd like to begin this interview with a letter Harry wrote to friends and his bride, Martha, also known to us as Marty Pill. Will read.
To my friends who understand old people, as I get older, I often think back on what changes in my life took me in the direction that formed my life today, that formed my views, my thoughts, the way I approached life. Most younger people haven't had that defining time that changes direction of their life. I know I'm one of those people who repeats stories, achievements, and jokes to the point that most of you would rather I sit quietly and just listen. My wife is one of those people. But I've been doing a lot of wool gathering, of remembering. Hey, I'm old, I get to. So I just want to share some thoughts I've had for a long time now. Take it, leave it, whatever, a cathartic memory of a 75-year-old man. Many of you will remember back to 1968, out of high school, starting college, maybe starting a family. 1968 was a very big year in U.S. history. It was a year that changed my life in profound ways and the year that I grew up as a person. In January of 1966, I was drafted in the U.S. Army. It was not by choice, but in those days, you didn't have a choice. During my first week in the military, like everyone else, I took a series of tests for placement. I did well in almost all areas of the test and decided to take the officer candidate test. I passed and was eligible for officer candidate school. About 5 weeks into basic training, some 40 of us were asked to attend a meeting where OCS was to be explained. We were all told that it would be the hardest 6 months of our life. I was a young, cocky kid who didn't really think it would be harder than basic, so I decided to apply. After numerous interviews and meetings, I was told I would be able to attend. My next step after basic was to take infantry training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. The Army was really nice to me and gave me my orders to attend OCS on my birthday. With that, I was off to Fort Benning, Georgia. It didn't take me long to realize that they were right. OCS was going to be really tough. The Army reasoned that if they put hard pressure on you now, you would be able to keep your cool under combat conditions, make fast decisions when needed, be a leader. During training, our group was told that we needed to look around at everyone because on graduation day, there would only be about 50% of us graduating. They were right. 54% of my class made it. Truth be told, I was lucky and fortunate to make it, but I'm proud that I did. I tell you this not to say I was good. I wasn't that good. I endured. And pride had a lot to do with it. I was raised by parents of the Depression who valued a paying job over college. Not that their expectations were low for their children. They just couldn't understand that there was something more. OCS was my something more, something I never thought I'd have, the opportunity to prove there was more to me than just getting by. Upon graduating from OCS, I received orders to Korea. Needs of the Army. Korea was short of officers, so 15 members of my class received the same orders. After a long 15-hour flight, we arrived at Kimpo Air Force Base. The next day, we all got our assignments. I was sent to Camp Casey as part of an infantry battalion that backed up companies on the DMZ. I had many assignments that year, ranging from battalion motor officer to company executive officer. On January 23, 1968, the North Koreans seized the USS Pueblo. 82 crew members were taken prisoner, and one member of the crew was killed. That was not reported. What was not reported was that at the same time of the capture, the North Koreans sent infiltrators to cross the DMZ. South Korea was put on a curfew from sundown to sunrise, and the U.S. Army and the South Korean Army running contact patrols during the night to find the North Koreans. Yours truly was the OIC of several of those patrols. Why was this not reported in the U.S. press? Because on January 30, 1968, North Vietnam launched the Tet Offensive. In mid-February 1968, my company deployed to a location in the southern part of Korea for a project to MSA, the Maximum Security Area. While I still cannot say much about the area for security reasons, I can tell you that it was of vital importance that this area be protected from attack by the North Korean soldiers. I spent several months at this location before I was sent home in May of 1968 to a new assignment at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I was assigned as a company commander of Company A, and we were sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia, to be the demonstration company for a new school called CDOC, Civil Disturbance Orientation Course. Fort Gordon is home of the military police school, and the CDOC course was designed for mayors, chiefs of police, and high-ranking military officers. If you remember history, Martin Luther King was shot and killed earlier that year. That caused a number of big city riots, and cities were not prepared for those types of issues, which is why the MP school created CDOC. The course was 5 days long from Monday through Friday. The attendees would arrive on Sunday and begin the classwork on Monday. Our demonstrations would begin on Tuesday and continue with a night demo on Thursday night. If we were not doing demos, we were practicing. It was always a full week. Riots in the cities were continuing during the entire year. The biggest was in Chicago during the political convention of 1968. The U.S. hadn't seen anything like this. I have hoped that the time and work my company put in helped somewhat. In late September, I returned to Fort Campbell with my company and was reassigned to the battalion office. In 1968, the Army had placed a detachment of the Old Guard unit at Fort Campbell. The Old Guard unit was the same unit that is currently in Washington, D.C., which is assigned to protect the tomb of the unknown soldier in Arlington Cemetery. I was made officer in charge of funeral details. For those who have not seen a military funeral, is one of the most moving ceremonies you will ever witness. I had many duties, but the hardest was to present the U.S. flag displayed on the coffin to the next of kin. I can't begin to tell you how emotional that was, the worst 2 weeks of my life. I still hate attending funerals. After 2 weeks of funeral detail, I was sent back to my normal duties. Honestly, 2 weeks is about all you can handle. Your emotions get stressed more than I can explain. My new job was the S1 of the battalion, which also made me the battalion commander's aide. Talk about a power trip. I was in charge of all personal assignments and the commander's schedule. Only the battalion EO and the sergeant major of the battalion had more or equal authority. It should be noted that the S1 job is normally held by a captain who has served years of service. The year ended quietly from that point. March of 1969 didn't come soon enough. I had served the required 2 years. I requested to be relieved of active duty, but I did have a few problems getting that done. It seems, as I put it, I screwed up in reverse. I had excellent officer performance reports in the 90 percentiles. Many of the officers above me thought I should be a lifer, and the Army didn't want to let me go. It took me a lot of talking, but I finally got relieved of duty. Those experiences from 1968 showed me I had abilities I never knew I could take on. I not only found myself involved in some of U.S. history, but I found a patriotic gene that will never go away. I found that I could do more than what my parents had expected. I found a need to give back to my country in my own way. I shared and instilled in my sons values that they will never lose. I get more emotional these days. I think back more. I guess it's just the natural state of aging. I hope some of you give thought to a time that was a turning point for you and maybe share it with your family and friends.
You just heard a letter written by Harry A. Pill. His bride read that letter. Thank you, Marty. I would like to continue with actually interviewing the veteran, Harry A. Pill. Harry was born August 19, 1944, to Fred Allen Pill and Dorothy Lucille Wilkie. He was born in Kansas City, Kansas. You heard a lot of Harry's background military life, but I'd like to tell you a little more about him growing up. Harry, where were you born, and where did you grow up?
I was born at Providence Hospital in Kansas City, Kansas. I grew up in what is known as Strawberry Hill at 6th and Orville. And I grew up in a very poor family. I had three older sisters and my mom and dad, and we lived in a four-room apartment above an automotive business. And we were there till I was about 12 years old. And then we moved and ultimately settled into a small home that, thanks to my mother's uncle, we were able to afford. He gave us the money for the down payment.
What was your relationship like with your parents?
Well, it's hard to say because my dad had a job with the Board of Public Utilities, and he worked shifts. So he would work 7 to 3, 3 to 7, 11 to 7, and he had kind of rotated, so there were many times I didn't see him very often. But he instilled into me a number of things, one being my love of sports. He had been a semi-pro baseball player in Iowa before he got married, and he was a catcher, and he wanted me to be a catcher. I couldn't handle that. I ultimately became a third baseman. He taught me how to switch hit, and I played either baseball or softball till I was about 37 or 38 years old.
I did not know that about you, Harry. Something I'd like to add here, Harry and I had a working relationship. I've known Harry since 1986, I believe.
And it was before that, wasn't it, 70s?
No, was it really?
I wasn't married to her.
Okay.
We got married in 79.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's even further than that.
Yeah, it's even further back than that.
I'm learning, as you are learning, hearing this recording, a lot about Harry. And that leads me to ask you another question. You talked about your dad and his interest for mm-hmm. baseball. Now I understand why you were so involved with baseball. Mm-hmm. Was it Ben Johnson?
Yes.
You were very involved with that as well.
I was given the job of being the bank representative from UMB to the Ben Johnson League. And I stayed involved in the league until August of 2019. And that was 30 years. And
yes.
I resigned because the head of the league that I was 75 years old. I'd been involved for 30 years. It was time for fresh blood to come in and thoughts. She didn't want me to do it, but I prevailed.
Stepped down.
Which shocked me because in November of that same year, after I resigned from the board, she called me and told me I was going to have to attend the annual awards dinner in December of 2019, and I said, is there a reason for it? She said, yes, we're going to put you into the Ben Johnson Baseball Hall of Fame. So I tease people and tell them I'm a baseball Hall of Famer.
And your dad would be proud of you.
Yes, he would. He would love that.
And again, I have to give you a little insight there, is how I found Harry after all the years. He came out in our local newspaper, The Courier, in Kearney, Missouri, and that's where I saw Harry was being recognized for this award, and that's when I made the connection to interviewing, because it gave your background as your military background.
Yeah, it did.
What did you think your life would be like when you were older, when you were growing up? Your dad wanted you to be a ball player, obviously, but what did you think?
I really didn't know. There was a time I thought I wanted to be an attorney, and I guess that's because I saw him on TV a lot. I don't know. But I never really got to that point. As I got out of high school, I started going to college, and there were a number of things that I was taking, just general courses, and I ended up getting a degree in education. To teach social and
history,
and did student teaching at Shawnee Mission East, and as opposed to taking the job of teaching, because I graduated in mid-year, it was at the end of December, I got a job at what was then City National Bank and Trust Company, because I needed a job, and next thing you know, I'm spending about 40 years in banking.
I do remember that.
Yeah, we do.
Tell me a little bit about your family heritage. What is your ethnic background?
Well, I was raised in a Protestant family. My dad had some German in him and some English. The name Peel tells you that. And my mother was of the same persuasion. Her maiden name, Wilkie, some people tell me it was a lot German. But so I'm kind of a European mole of a lot of things.
So what traditions have been passed down in your family? Can you name a few?
Oh, boy. It's hard to say. With three older sisters, I grew up with four mothers. I didn't get away with anything. In fact, there were times my mother actually looked at my sisters and said, take it easier on him. You're pounding him too hard. You're hurting him. And so a lot of things that I grew up with came from being involved in the Order of De Molay, came from sports, and we were members and of the Central Avenue Methodist Church, and I got heavily involved there. And as time went on, as I grew older, all of those came in as factors of my life.
Right. So who were your favorite relatives, Harry? I don't think I've ever heard you talk about your relatives, your parents and your sisters,
okay.
But never your relatives.
Well, I have to tell you that when my mother and father got married, my father's relatives did not like her. And bear in mind, my mother and father were married 62 years, so there must have been something for them. And so we were kind of estranged from my father's family. And my mother's family lived in Moline, Illinois, where my mother and father had met and got married and moved to Kansas City for a job. My favorite relative in Moline was my mother's sister, my Aunt Margaret. And my wife is sitting here and she knows why. My Aunt Margaret was, how do I say it? She was a pistol. She didn't clean her house but once a month, if it needed it then. She would cook, and dishes might sit in the kitchen for 2 or 3 days before she'd even think about cleaning them. She was not into that, but she was fun. She wanted to have fun. All the other stuff didn't matter to her. And being around her, it was really fun. And then I'd come home and meet, and my mother was the disciplinarian who cleaned the house like crazy. I mean, two sisters could not have been more opposite.
Oh, good. I have to remember that. Let's talk a little bit about your marriage. How did you meet Marty?
Well, I trained her. Now, she got a job at the bank, and they gave me the opportunity to educate her in personal banking. Mm-hmm. So I spent a couple of weeks with her. We got to know each other. One thing kind of led to another over time, and we began dating. And it didn't take me long to realize this is the gal I wanted to spend my life with. But it took me a long time to convince her, though. I finally actually said to her, I'm never going to bring up marriage again. You will have to do it. And she swears that I got her drunk one night after work at a happy hour, and that's why she proposed.
Is that true, Marty?
Oh, very much so. Yes.
The fact he got you drunk, that's the part that's true.
That is okay. The part that is true.
So what advice do you have for young couples, Harry?
You know, I think what you have to understand, and you understand this, I know, you and Danny have been married forever too. Mm-hmm. You have to have give and take. Yes. You have to care deeply about one another, and you have to understand each other. She has her likes, dislikes, and I have my likes and dislikes, and we have to accept those things. And you just have to, I say, you have to be a team. Mm-hmm. Life means that when you're working with more than just yourself, you're with other people, you have to know what teamwork is. And I see people who don't understand teamwork, and I feel sorry for them, because being a part of playing sports and being a part of the military, it taught me team. And I think more and more people need to understand that.
I agree. Is there anything else you'd like to add about directing young couples who are getting married today? Anything that stands out that you want to share so down the road that your children can even listen to this?
A commitment.
Yes.
It's what it is. You have to understand you're not just doing this just to get married. You're doing this because you care deeply about someone, and you're choosing to spend the rest of your life with that individual. And when we got married, I will tell you, there was no doubt in my mind this was the gal I wanted to spend my life with. And 42 years later, we're still doing it.
I'm glad to hear that. We talked a little bit about your working, and I don't want to go in there and dwell it anymore, but what did you think you were going to be when you grew up? Your dad was trying to persuade you into the athletic area, and you said you had looked into maybe possibly an attorney. Was there anything else that you haven't mentioned that you had thought about that you would like to be? I mean, you're obviously a retired banker.
Well, there was a time, and we're talking about the military, that I actually, as an officer, thought about making the military a career. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, do you really want to spend your life going from one fort to another, to one country to another, and have a family, and you would see other families being separated for 13 months at a time and all that stuff? And I just couldn't accept that. I didn't want to do that. I always tell people, and she read it in there, that I screwed up in reverse. I took the job very seriously when I graduated from OCS, and I had these great officer efficiency reports, and they didn't want to let me out. And truth be told, I had to go to the commanding general of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to let me out, and his aide told me he wasn't going to let me do it. He wanted me to stay, and I convinced him that this is what I had to do. This is what I wanted. I didn't want to be a career guy. And so the general, two-star general, let me out. It's a true story.
You persuaded him.
Huh?
You persuaded him.
I just told him in no uncertain terms that I'd given it my best, but it was time for me to do something else.
Well, good. Well, you touched it on a little bit when you were saying you were thinking about a career in the military. Tell us a little bit about raising your children. When did you first find out that you would be a parent, and how did you feel?
Well, let's just say that when we got married, my wife made no bones about it. She wanted to have kids. So I knew from the get-go we were going to have some children. And we agreed that two would be the best number for a number of reasons. You know, we were later in life. Are you agreeing with me? Yeah, she's going, okay. And we had two sons, and they're terrific kids. But the fact of the matter is, I think there was some disappointment we didn't have a daughter, because I think two grandmothers both wanted a daughter to spoil, or granddaughter, I should say, to spoil. And particularly Marty's mother was really wanting to spoil a granddaughter. And when the second child was born and it was another son, I think there was some disappointment by some parents. No? Marty's saying no. Okay.
No, we couldn't have been happier.
We couldn't have been, but
I think the most amazing thing was when we had our first one, it was the first baby Harry had ever held. He had never held an infant before. And I think that was just so awe-inspiring for him. He was good with them. Never being around small babies, he came right into the fore. It was love, and it was a good experience for him. And they're good kids. They were very proud of both of our sons.
You're very fortunate. Yes.
We are.
Dallin and Christopher. Yes.
They are great kids.
Yes.
Really?
Do you have any favorite stories about your children, your two sons, Alan and Christopher?
They each did their own thing in many ways. One of the things that I will tell people forever, two events, one for each son, really rocked my boat and made me proud. My oldest son, Alan, took into sports, and he still is. He's deeply involved in sports. He's an assistant basketball coach at a local high school now, and he's involved in all kinds of sports and academia. And his senior night, he was the special teams captain on the football team in high school. And his senior night, they had parents and the player on the fields. And mom got flowers from her son. And we all stood there and had our photos taken. That was a very special occasion, I think, for both of us. And then I would have to say, the next special occasion had to do with our son Chris. He played sports for a while, but it wasn't his thing. But he got an Eagle Scout award, and he'd worked very hard for it, and that was quite an accomplishment. So at some point, and they continue to be successful, don't get me wrong, they did something of some magnitude that showed their personalities and what they wanted.
I would say so, definitely. And Christopher?
Yeah, well, he's the Eagle Scout.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Here's a few questions for you, Harry. We covered family, military, your background, your parents. What was the happiest moment of your life?
Oh, that's a trick question. Yeah. No, the happiest moment of my life had to be marrying Marty. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Great.
And I just think it was just one of those lucky things that I found her.
And I remember when you did.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yes,
yeah, she
was.
She was there.
I was there. Who was the most important person in your life, and can you tell me about him or her?
Wow.
Especially growing up, was there someone, you mentioned your father, was directing you, that he wanted you to play sports.
Probably, I would have to say my oldest sister. She was the oldest of the three.
Was that Rose?
No, that was Dolores.
Dolores.
Dolores was the youngest.
Okay.
Dolores
was the youngest.
Dolores was the stable person. She was the one who would intervene when my other two sisters, Marilyn and Rose, would start going out the deep end with me, she would stop them. And she'd say, now, wait a minute, blah, blah, blah. She was the one that kept me grounded. And she got married and moved out of the house. But I still stayed in close touch with her. And she just was the stability.
Okay. Who has been the biggest influence on your life, and what lessons did that person teach you? And I know that you again have mentioned your father. He influenced you, mm-hmm. that he wanted you to go towards that. Now you mentioned Dolores.
Wow.
And the military, you also told me, you know, how they guided you and prepared you for life. I mean, yeah. a lot of lessons you learned there that you could accomplish.
Boy.
And you can take a minute to pause and think about that. I mean, that's not something that you can
just... You know, it is a tough question because there were so many people who helped me. But I'd have to say my sister Dolores and my dad were the biggest influences on my life because of the way they wanted to be. I can't think of anybody else that...
Now, you did mention that your father had a brother and your mother had a sister. Were they the only two siblings on each side?
No, my my father had a couple of sisters and a couple of brothers. But again, we became estranged from them because they didn't want my mother. They didn't want to marry, and one thing led to another, and I really never knew them much. It was only on a few occasions that I even had any contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I talked about to some people recently, now that my mother and father and three sisters are all deceased, and my relatives in Moline are all deceased, I don't know of any other relative I have that's out there. I know of some distant cousins, but I don't know where they are, what they're doing, and that's about it. As far as I know, I'm the last one.
The last peel.
But again, I was the younger one, and all the others were older, and I'm fortunate that at age 77, I'm still kicking.
So what are the most important lessons you learned in life, Harry? I know you go back to the military, you keep swaying that way. You were very young when you went into the military, so I can understand it.
I'll tell you what.
Influenced you.
I laugh about that because I have three codes that I go by. And one of them is always do the right thing, no matter what. Second, you can never have too many friends. No such thing. And last but not least, I say prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance. It's not that you plan to fail, you fail to plan. So sometimes I drive my wife nuts. I'm a planner, and she doesn't always go that wild. Is that fair?
Not always.
Not always.
Well, that leads me perfectly to my next question. How would you like to be remembered, Harry?
I don't know, just that I always did the right thing, that I was a pretty good guy. I didn't, it's pretty hard for me to have you as a friend if you're not the right kind of person. You know, I look at it and I say, anybody who lies a lot or doesn't do the right thing, I don't want to be around you. I don't want anything to do with you because I can't trust you. And if I can't trust you, I don't want to be your friend.
Perfect. Do you have any regrets?
Yeah. Oh, I think I have a lot of regrets. For a number of things.
Okay.
You know. But
any you'd like to share?
Not really.
Okay.
But the fact is, I think we all regret certain decisions you make or don't make. I tried to make all the right decisions. But there are times I look back and say, what if I had done this? And in retrospect, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it's all history and I can't change it.
Exactly. That's exactly true. Two more questions. You talked a lot about your military life, how mm-hmm. your life was more or less directed. But I didn't hear you mention anything about military relationships that you had there, in as much as, you know, there's a camaraderie mm-hmm. with the platoon that you go with. Do you keep with touch with any of the friends from that time, Harry?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been in touch with them. But yes, I tell the story that in Korea, there were three of us, and John Purcell, who was from California, Ernie Beck, who was from Long Island, and me from Kansas City. And we told everybody we had the country covered from coast to coast and in the middle. And we were the organizers of, I don't know how many fun things that were done. Probably the biggest one happened, we were sitting in the officers club one evening and the battalion commander, a Lieutenant Colonel Peabody, came in and he said, monsoon's going on, and I noticed the creek, we had a bunch of people floating down the creek today on air mattresses. It wouldn't be that one of you organized this, would it? And Ernie looked up, he's from New York, and he said, yes, sir, it was me. Because we were always doing something like that. And it released the pressure on the company he was assigned to. Mm-hmm. And he had done it the proper, I mean, he had it all organized. He had people along the side of the creek with ropes in case somebody came off, because this was a raging thing. And they were having fun, and it was safe. And but that was just one example of, if we were always being blamed for doing those things, the three of us. And then a new guy came in, and we, Jesse J. Hinton Jr., who later ended up being a career officer and being a lieutenant colonel. And Jesse was an Afro-American. And Ernie used to always tell Jesse to go to the back of the bus. But it was all in
fun
because Jesse became number four. Instead of three of us, it was a fourth. And I love Jesse like a brother. I still smile. I'm smiling now. You can see it every time I think about him, because Jesse was a very deeply religious man. But he was fun.
I'm glad you had those memories.
Yeah.
Last question. For the generations coming up, thinking about going into the military, what words of wisdom do you have for this future generation when they're considering going into the military? It's so different now than when you mm-hmm. went into the military. They don't have to be drafted any longer. The draft is gone by the wayside. Do you have any words of wisdom for that future generation considering?
No, I don't know that there is, other than go into it with the right attitude. Make sure that you give it your all. Remember one thing. You're in this together. And if you get in a combat situation, you got to trust to the guy to the right and to the left. And all the other guys around you. You have to have that trust. You have to work hard at it. And you have to be a team, because when it comes to giving an order, when the bullets are flying, you got to be able to accept the order and do it. Just that simple. The other thing that I'll say real quick, I think this country needs to reinstate the draft. I think that I see society now, the younger people so loosey-goosey, they have no control over themselves, no control over discipline, and that's what the military teaches you. It teaches you wisdom, discipline, and how to go at it hard. And I'm saddened that we don't have a draft anymore. I'd like to see, and I want women as part of it this time. I don't think it should be just men.
And I agree with that, concur, definitely. We all want to be treated equally. then that's
yeah,
the
if
equal
you want
part.
To be treated equally,
equally that's part
of serve
it.
Equally.
Make
right.
a commitment to the United States. Make a commitment. If you don't want to serve in the military, then serve in community service.
Could I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. A lot of people don't know this. Maybe you remember it, Marie. I know Marty does. In the 1970s, I got the opportunity to teach citizenship classes to legal immigrants who wanted to become U.S. citizens. And in the 1970s, you had to speak English and learn U.S. history and government. You had to speak English before I could teach the class, because I had people from all over the world. I didn't speak 20 different languages. So when I'd have this class of anywhere from 5 to 30 people, and we met twice a week for a semester, I actually got a reputation because I didn't give the test. It was given by the Office of Immigration and Naturalization. And I got a reputation toward the end of my tenure. I did it for like 8 or 9 years, that when people would go into the office to take their oral history and government test, they would ask them, have you taken a class? Yes. Who was your instructor? Mr. Peel. And the next answer was, you pass. And it got to be a joke. And I never knew anybody in that office. I never went into that office. But every time we'd have the class successful and they all graduated, we had a party. And it was, everybody would bring their own food from their country. Mm-hmm. And it was just wonderful. And that was one of the best experiences of my life, was meeting those people and helping them become citizens. One of them was a veterinarian from Egypt. And he treated our dogs for how many years, Marty?
Long time.
Yeah.
That is.
That's what I would suggest for people. We need to become a country again. We need to stop this, what I call the BS, and move on and become a country. Not political.
Well, Harry, I want to thank you again for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the interview. And your bride, Marty, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.